Good morning and welcome to Kadampa Center. Please put your cell phones on mute or vibrate. And if you have any questions for Geshe Gelug, he's not here this weekend, he's at the retreat. But if you have questions for him to answer in the future, please write them down and put them on the music stand or in the box next to the prayer request. There is also now an online form to submit questions on our website on the Sunday program page. All the prayers we will recite can be found in the white prayer book. Please use the book on the back of your chair or at the end of the pew. When Robbie arrives, who is teaching this morning, it is our tradition to stand and show respect to the teacher and the teaching. Robbie's already here. You missed your chance. Robbie will lead us in three prostrations out of respect for the Buddha's teachings and for the enlightened qualities of the Buddha and our own innate Buddha nature. If you feel uncomfortable prostrating, you are welcome to remain standing. We have some opening prayers, and then Steve is going to do an announcement. So let's go ahead and start with our prayers, and then Steve will come in and announce. Okay. Okay, so in the prayer book on the first base sheet, we will recite Shakyamuni Buddha's mantra three times, the Four Immeasurables in both English and Tibetan, and the Chenrezig mantra and the Tara mantra. So we'll begin with Shakyamuni Buddha's mantra. Ta ta mune mune maha munaye soha ta ta mune mune maha munaye soha Taya ta mune mune maha munaye soha. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Sam Chan Tam Che De Wa Dong De Wei Kyu Dong Den Par Kyu Chi Chenrezig mantra eight times. I think that's on the bottom of the first sheet of the pink page. Om Mani Padme Hum. 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 And now we'll do 7 green Tara mantras. Om Tare Tu Tare Ture Soha. 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 Om Tare Tu Tare Ture Soha.
Yeah, I think, okay. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Dhamma Center, our second 9 a.m. session. Do we have anyone who's here for the very first time today? Oh, a couple of people. Welcome. Glad to have you here. Let's begin with some meditation. We'll just do a very simple breathing meditation to help our mind become more focused and more concentrated and also quieter. So begin by checking your posture. And if you're not familiar with the posture, the important parts of the back is a little bit straighter than you normally sit. Eyes are either lightly closed or slightly open. Shoulders are down and back. Upper arms away from the sides of your torso. Right hand on left with the thumbs touching. Legs in a position that you find comfortable and stable. And begin by taking 3 deep breaths in and out through both nostrils with the stomach expanding on the in-breath. And having done that, allow your breathing to return to its normal pattern. And take a moment to set your motivation that you have come to Kadampa Center this morning and are doing the meditation and participating in the discussion to follow, so that even though it seems maybe a little far-fetched or grandiose, so that your mind will change in a way so that you can be of greater benefit to all living beings. And having set your motivation, now begin the meditation itself, a simple concentration meditation in which we just pay attention to the movement of the breath in and out through the nostrils. The physical tactile sensation of air moving in the nostrils and out. Nothing more, nothing less than that. And every time we notice that our concentration has wandered off to another object, as it inevitably will, we gently bring it back and place it on the breath again, over and over. And that's the meditation. And we can end our meditation by doing a brief dedication. We give ourselves a pat on the back, acknowledge that we've done something beneficial, and may the energy that we've created not be dissipated or lost, but may it ripen in a way that benefits all sentient beings. Okay, so the discussion this morning, and it's very much a discussion, not a lecture, is, Steve brought up happiness. Geshe Gelug has been talking about happiness for the last few weeks here. So I wanted to, I was asked to continue the discussion on happiness. Some people think Buddhism and happiness is a contradiction. Some people think Buddhism is a very gloomy, depressing philosophy or religion. We talk a lot about death and we talk a lot about suffering, but we don't necessarily talk about happiness a whole lot. But there is quite a bit in the teachings of the Buddha about happiness, both short-term happiness in this lifetime and then the ultimate state of pure joy and bliss that we refer to as Buddhahood, the state of becoming a Buddha, which is a possibility for each of us if we completely develop our innate capacity for compassion and wisdom. We become a Buddha, and all the teachings tell us that that's, you know, pure bliss. But I find that when we start to try and talk about what it's like to be a Buddha, it gets very divorced from what our everyday life is like. And the Buddha also said it is possible to experience happiness before you become a Buddha. And I think that's an important point, and it's one that I tend to forget. We do experience happiness. We do have pleasurable experiences in this lifetime. And from the Buddha's point of view, the more pleasurable experiences, the more happiness you have, the better. It's not something to be avoided or something to be pushed away. You don't have to say, I'm a good Buddha, so I can't be happy, I can't do anything pleasurable. The question is, what is the nature of pleasurable or happy experiences? And I'm going to use pleasure and happiness as pretty much synonymous as we start this discussion. We certainly talk a lot about suffering also, though, when we talk about how happy experiences or pleasurable experiences have the characteristic of turning into unhappiness, what we refer to as the suffering of change. And that's something that is initially quite pleasurable with repetition or over time becomes less pleasurable, less pleasurable, less pleasurable, till it ultimately gets to the point of being unhappiness or suffering. And we can use a very gross example like eating ice cream, where the initial experience of eating ice cream is pleasurable, but as it continues over a certain amount of time, it becomes boring, and then if we're forced to continue, it becomes actual suffering. So it implies that something is changing, and we know it's not the ice cream that's changing, it's the way that we're interacting with the ice cream that's changing. So what is initially happiness can become unhappiness. And that's referred to as the suffering of change, one of the most common types of suffering that we have in this lifetime. But that does not deny the fact that the initial experience of the ice cream is pleasurable or is happiness. Okay? So the question is to look at why is that initial experience happiness and what happens to make it change. And there's a wonderful quote from Shantideva. His book is called A Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, if you're not familiar with it. There are multiple translations available in the bookstore. This was written in the 8th century? Yes, the 8th century. He is an Indian scholar of Buddhism. And it's just full of wonderful quotes and pithy statements. It's everybody's favorite Buddhist book, I think, in a lot of ways. This quote is, although wishing to be free of suffering, we run towards suffering itself. although wishing to have happiness, like an enemy, we ignorantly destroy it. So Shantideva is saying that though we wish to be free of unhappiness, we run towards it. Though we wish to have happiness, we ignorantly destroy it. If you go to teachings by His Holiness the Dalai Lama, he frequently starts his teachings off with the statement that everyone wants to be happy, everyone wants to avoid unhappiness. That's a natural part of being a human being. We all have this innate wish to be happy, and there's nothing selfish or self-centered about that. That's a completely valid and justifiable aspiration as far as Buddhism is concerned. The wish to be happy, go for it. The question is, according to Shantideva, we don't know how to do it. So, first thing we need to do is define happiness. Anybody want to take a stab at, it doesn't have to be the official Buddhist definition. Anybody want to try and define what happiness is? Andre.
I think happiness is contentment.
Contentment, okay, very good. That's very good. The word that I was going to use is being comfortable with something, but contentment, okay, great. Anybody else want to take a stab at it? Yeah.
In the moment,
okay, contentment in the moment. Very good. Yeah, Dave.
Peace of mind.
Peace of mind, okay, great. Okay. We've got some experienced Buddhist in here. Obviously, people are describing what's going on in the mind, okay? It's not related to the external object is not the source of happiness from what I hear people saying. Okay. Anybody else want to give us a definition?
Absence of suffering.
Okay, that's a good, yeah. Mm-hmm. Joy, okay. It's sounding too dull, too much like a bowl of oatmeal for you or something. Yeah, okay. Joy, okay. Bliss is a word that's used. Okay. According to the Buddhist point of view, and I'm just going to give the party line here, you don't have to accept this, but just that's where the discussion is starting. Happiness is... It's a subsegment of what's referred to as a mental factor, okay, which is a mental experience, and it's the one that specifically is referred to as feeling. It's part of the mental factor known as feeling. And feeling is the part of our mind that experiences things or perceives things. For example, I perceive this blue cup, I experience this blue cup, and immediately the mental factor of feeling arises. And that feeling may be, I really like the cup. I really don't like the cup. I really don't give a flying patootie about the cup. Or anywhere along that continuum from really liking to really disliking, neutral in the middle. That's feeling. The really liking part is happiness, pleasure. Happiness. I get a pleasurable experience from looking at the cup. That's what we're referring to as ordinary happiness, the happiness that we experience in this life. Okay, it's pleasurable, okay? We like having that feeling. Nothing wrong, nothing selfish, nothing that hurts others by having that feeling. It can be, I really like it, I kind of like it, I don't really care, I dislike it, I really hate it. Okay, anywhere along that continuum is feeling, with the happiness being over on one end, unhappiness being on the other end. Feeling arises spontaneously with everything that we come into contact with. It may be very subtle or very trivial, we don't even notice it, but everything that we see, that we smell, that we taste, that we touch, everything that we think of, every thought, is accompanied by feeling. Every memory, every plan, everything is accompanied by this mental factor of feeling, which is somewhere on that continuum from I really like it to I really don't like it. Most of the time we don't even notice that we're so out of tune with what's going on in our mind that we're not even aware of most of our feelings. But that's something that we can develop in meditation. What is it that determines, when I see the blue cup, what is it that determines, I say, I really like it, that gives me pleasure, that gives me happiness. What's the cause of that feeling? Why do I say I like the blue cup instead of I hate the blue cup?
Past experience,
okay. Be a little more Buddhist about it. Karma, yeah. That's the result of past actions of body, speech, and mind. These feelings of liking, not liking, don't care, that arise in reaction to everything we experience are the results of the past, what we've done in the past. And we've all developed certain karmic habits. We like certain things. We don't like certain things. We've created the cause for this. But the fact that we have a pleasurable, a happy experience is the result of past karma, okay? Is the result of what kind of karma would cause pleasurable feelings or happy feelings to arise?
Positive.
Yeah, positive karma, which is, let me say positive karma, virtuous karma. How would you define that?
Actions that cause happiness for others.
No. Wrong answer. Wrong. You've got the right stuff in there, but you've kind of mixed it up a little bit, okay? Anybody want to take a stab at it? What actions in the past caused my happiness looking at the blue cup? What's the cause of me to experience pleasure looking at the blue cup? Andre? Yeah, which is what Donna said initially, and then
right. Yeah, so I think when we've had like a in the past we've had a pleasurable experience with the color blue, then that's imprinted.
You're getting a little too involved here. Yeah, I'm looking for a simpler answer.
Okay.
Mm-hmm, yeah, it's specific. Yeah, specifically. Actions that are not motivated by anger, attachment, and ignorance. Okay, anything that's not motivated by those three negative minds makes a karmic imprint that in the future, at some point in the future, causes me to experience happiness. Okay, that's where you got kind of confused. Actions towards others that are not motivated by anger, attachment, or ignorance, ignorance being a lack of understanding of reality, create the karma for me to experience happiness in the future. Not necessarily. Not necessarily. It's so complicated. Okay? So we'll get, I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but we'll get back to that. So, every time we interact with an object, a person, an idea, a smell, a taste, or a touch, a feeling arises, either a feeling of pleasure and happiness or a feeling of unhappiness and displeasure. The cause of that feeling arising is our karma, our actions in the past. Okay? Actions that were not motivated by anger, attachment, or ignorance. Okay? I'm going to go on and define happiness a little bit more clearly from the Buddhist point of view. Happiness is said to be, and this is from a wonderful website by Alex Berzin, A-L-E-X-B-E-R-Z-I-N. He has a huge website. Just look up Alex Berzin on the internet, and it has a huge website. He's a really distinguished scholar of Tibetan Buddhism, and everything on there is very, very accurate and precise, so it's a great reference point. Happiness is experiencing something in a satisfying manner. That kind of gets back to what y'all were saying in the definition, based on believing that it is a benefit to ourselves. And it's also so we are comfortable with it. So it's experiencing something in a satisfying manner, in a way that we are comfortable with. Okay, when we like something, we're comfortable with it. If we dislike it, we're uncomfortable with it. It could be an object, a person, a memory. Okay, those that we are comfortable with, that we find satisfying, that's happiness. And they have another characteristic, and when that feeling has ended, we wish to meet with it again. We want to have that feeling again. And this is completely, I'm not getting into a, not yet, these are completely valid, you know, this is just the way things are. There's nothing wrong about wanting to experience happiness again. That's a completely valid reason, a valid motivation. It's only it says everybody wants to be happy. We all want to have more happy feelings. Okay? So happiness is experiencing something in a way that we find satisfying and comfortable, and we want to have that experience again. So that's a more technical definition of what happiness is, according to Buddhism. Yeah. Well, that's the next. I don't know if I can tell you how to avoid it, but that's the next step. So, of course, that's a, you know, there's nothing negative about what I've described so far. A comfortable, satisfying feeling that we want to have over and over. Great. It doesn't hurt anybody. It doesn't create any negative karma. But then what happens? We get attached. And attachment is different from wanting to have that experience again. Attachment is characterized. The definition of attachment is overemphasizing the good qualities of that experience. So you're, from the basic Buddhist point of view, you're losing touch with reality. You're projecting onto the experience qualities it doesn't have. So you're projecting onto it qualities of permanence. This person is always going to stay the same. They're not going to change. They're always going to do what I want them to do. They're always going to love me. A quality of being able to make me happy all the time rather than just this one-time experience of happiness. And attachment is characterized by clinging, grasping, greed, all those negative things. We take a happy experience and we become attached to it. In the same way with a negative experience, an unhappy experience, we project onto it qualities that it doesn't have, that it's going to make me permanently unhappy, that I don't want it, that I want to push it away. Okay? So we go from the initial pleasurable experience, comfortable, satisfying, we want to have it again, and then we grab onto it, say, I've got to have this. It can't change. It has to stay like this. If it does change, I'm unhappy. Okay? The first part is completely valid, is an accurate perception of reality from the, if you get into deep Buddhism, seeing happy experiences as comfortable, satisfying, and wanting to have them again, great. Grasping onto them, clinging to them, attaching to them, big problem there. Okay? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Questions or discussions, anyone?
Guys in the prison that I teach, or whether it's my students at Wake Tech, when I talk about these kinds of things, I always get into the thing of, well, what about need, you know? And then we think about, like, the things that, the basic needs, food, clothing, shelter, that kind of stuff. And they always say, well, like, I need these, and they get that mixed up with having to have it, you know? So I was wondering if you can maybe distinguish between the need and attachment to.
Well, I think realizing that we need food to live is an accurate perception of reality. That's not attachment. Just saying I need to have X amount of calories per day to survive, I don't think implies attachment. If it has to be chocolate cake with chocolate icing every single day, that implies a quality of attachment to it. But recognizing what we need to do, I don't think is at all synonymous with attachment. In the same way, on our spiritual path, we recognize what we need to do to develop on our spiritual path, and we want to do. I mean, we can bring a quality of attachment, but we don't have to. You know, we want to make progress on our spiritual path. I don't think that's attachment. I think that's very different. I mean, maybe someone else can join in the discussion.
Yeah, I do find that there are some people who seem to be able to. That we have these basic needs, right? But they can do without food for some period of time.
Yeah,
they can do without, you know, like having clothing and shelter and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So what's going on there?
Well, I think that's some sort of spiritual development they've obtained that most of us don't have. I mean, most of us, our needs and our attachments are mixed up together. We're very attached. But I don't think they're necessarily synonymous, is all I can say. Okay. Yeah, over here.
This made me think about, we all need clothes,
mm-hmm.
but we don't need finery.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's a want. That's an attachment.
Yeah, I think so.
A T-shirt and shorts is a need,
mm-hmm, right.
At least at the minimum.
Yeah, in this society, yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's see, what else did I want to talk to? I think Alex may say something to address that. Let me check Andre. Yeah, I can't find that exact thing, okay. But, yeah. But I know he does say that, you know, we want to have food. Okay, wanting to have food is not a negative feeling, okay? Understand that we need food. We can want to do things, okay? We can want to achieve things. But if we bring that quality of attachment to it, then it turns into suffering. And that's how the suffering of change works. That's how pleasurable experiences turn into suffering, because we bring that attachment to it. We start with an initially pleasurable experience, and then we become attached to it. And that's what turns it into suffering and unhappiness. It's not that the object is changing. It's that the mind that we're bringing to it is changing. Rather than just staying with the initial pleasurable experience, we bring all this other interpretation and story to it, and that's why the experience turns into suffering. The ice cream doesn't change from pleasure to suffering. The ice cream's staying the same. It's the mind that's interacting with it that's changing continuously.
And so there's nothing wrong with wanting the ice cream.
If it's done without attachment, you know, knowing that ice cream is a pleasurable experience, and you want to have that experience again. That's completely valid from the Buddhist point of view. Wanting to have pleasurable, happy experiences is great. The more of them, the better from the Buddhist point of view. We shouldn't want to be unhappy. That's not what being a Buddhist is about, or pushing pleasure or happiness away. That's not what being a Buddhist is about at all. I think it's easy to misinterpret things in that way. I'm going to read a quotation from Alex Berzin here. As we have seen, when we experience an object with happiness, we experience it without the disturbing emotions of ignorance, lust, attachment, greed, repulsion, or anger. Our experiencing of the object is based on accepting its actual nature as what it is, without exaggerating or denying its good or bad points. This way of experiencing things, then, comes from the habit of constructive behavior, or virtuous behavior, or positive behavior, in which we act, speak, and think, likewise based on accepting the actual nature of what people or things or situations are, without exaggerating or denying their good or bad points. Okay? So that's what he's saying there at the end, is that negative karma tends to be created, negative karma, karma of anger, attachment, ignorance, tends to arise in a lot of situations from overreacting, over-exaggerating our negative feelings. We don't like something, or we don't like someone, so we push them away. We're angry at them. We hurt them. That creates negative karma, which will lead to more suffering in the future. If we accept them for what they are, let's say, this is an unpleasant person, I don't want to be around them, without projecting any more on that, we avoid creating that negative karma that would cause suffering in the future. If we see them as they are, rather than exaggerating their qualities, we avoid creating the negative karma, and we avoid creating the causes to suffer in the future.
Is what happens when somebody with whom I'm close, I feel is the cause of my anger,
mm-hmm.
Or concern. And what I did recently was I got very angry at someone's behavior, and a close Buddhist friend of mine said, well, that's karma in action, which just made me angrier. I chose to look at my own karma of anger,
mm-hmm.
and in the situation, and say, well, part of the reason my karma is that sometimes I don't do something when these situations arise.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say that is the way that we use karma, or the definition of karma, to then change?
Yeah, becoming aware of our karmic tendencies, mm-hmm. our karmic habits. I know when I'm in this situation, I tend to react this way. Yeah, I think that's a very valid way of reasoning, yeah. Mm-hmm. Any other comments? Okay, so virtuous actions create the cause for happiness. Non-virtuous actions create the cause for suffering for ourself. Happiness being that sense of contentment, of being comfortable with something and wanting to experience it again. Suffering being uncomfortable, uncontent, not wanting to experience it again. Those suffering experiences are basically a result of not seeing things the way they are. Okay? For example, in a situation you give when we get angry at someone for the way they behave, you made me angry. That's a misperception of what's going on. Other person is not making you angry. You're reacting based on past karmic tendencies, and also not seeing that the person whose behavior seems so unskillful is reacting based on their past karma, and there are all sorts of ways to, you know, you can argue with yourself. But negative actions tend to result from not seeing reality correctly. Okay? Positive actions tend to result from seeing things accurately, and they lead to happiness. But it's all, the important point is it's not determined by what's out there. It's all going on here. It's our mind and our karma. That's, you know, we all know this intuitively, that we're the source of our own happiness and unhappiness, but it's really hard to realize. But this is the Buddhist way of explaining that. It's how our karma and how our actions and our interpretation of things are the cause of our happiness or our unhappiness. And it basically comes down to accepting the reality, seeing reality correctly, and being comfortable with it, and being satisfied with it. That leads to happiness in this lifetime, okay? We're talking about happiness in this lifetime, not the state of being a Buddha. And, you know, it's not like we have to postpone being happy until we get to be a Buddha. We can actually work on that in this lifetime and have more pleasurable, more happy experiences, according to the teachings of the Buddha, by developing our understanding of these principles. That's what's the definition of compassion? Anybody? Can somebody give you the definition? Yes, Pat. Yeah, the wish that others be free of suffering. So is that a happy feeling or an unhappy feeling? This is a good question. And I can't answer this one. Is it suffering to be compassionate?
Yes,
by
definition.
Uh-huh.
Compassion means to suffer with. Compassion, the word itself, means to suffer with.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, that's a valid point of view. I'm going to say there's a wonderful Buddhist teacher who came here, and he said, the more compassionate you become, the happier you are.
I think there's a softening of the heart
mm-hmm.
that goes along with
yeah.
that, and that is a positive
yeah.
feeling.
So, Andre.
Yeah, I was thinking just that. The more compassion we generate, and the more compassion that we express, the happier our experience is, the happier
mm-hmm.
we become. That's been my personal
mm-hmm.
experience.
Yeah. Well, how can you jive that with being aware of the suffering of others?
Yeah, that's the thing, right? It's like I don't know, because I think what happens there, at least, because I'm thinking about this all the time, because I do recognize
mm-hmm.
the suffering of others, right? And then I feel this overwhelming compassion for them, which causes me to want to do something to alleviate
mm-hmm.
the suffering. And then when I actually do something to alleviate someone's suffering, then that brings me happiness. So I think it's just not just sitting there, just recognizing that people are suffering and we have compassion, but I think it's actually when we actually act on that and we actually do something
mm-hmm.
Then when we do that, then that generates happiness for,
mm-hmm.
for ourselves.
Yeah. Sylvia.
Yeah. My take on that is before we feel compassion for others, we first develop that for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And when we develop that for ourselves, we suffer less.
Mm-hmm.
So it comes through us first.
Mm-hmm.
And we get relief.
Yeah.
By having compassion for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a tricky question. Over here, let's see. Thank you, Tim, for running back and forth. Of course, nobody sat in the middle. Everybody sat to the edges of the room.
I think it's also a function of when your attention is turned towards others with compassion, then your attention isn't on yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Your own
yeah.
neediness. So
yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's see. Wait. Did you have a wait? Tim, back here. She was hit first here.
No, I was just thinking about the job I have had for 30 years. I see a lot of suffering. And I think I got to a point where, you know, when you feel that suffering so much
mm-hmm.
that then you're like, it's almost like, am I attached to compassion? You know
mm-hmm.
what I mean?
Yeah.
And then you get to a point to protect like a defense mechanism to protect yourself, at least in my case, had no compassion.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that makes
yeah.
sense.
Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly. You start to shut off from it. Exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think that there's the recognition that you're not alone when
mm-hmm.
you learn to open your heart and be compassionate. And that becomes a gift that you give
mm-hmm.
To others, and the gift you're giving is that they can recognize they're not alone,
mm-hmm.
and in a way you get to connect with it, that recognition that we're all in the same boat,
mm-hmm.
and that's a real gift.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Say, Jessica, did you?
The challenge that I have is that
a lot of times when I make a choice to support or to help someone out of compassion,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's my perception of what I think will alleviate their suffering
mm-hmm.
or will express compassion.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's my greatest challenge, is always to understand from the person what their true need is.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause it gets kind of tangled in what I think their need is. And was wondering if you could speak a little bit more to that, or what I can lean on in terms of the guidelines.
That's not today's class. It's a great, great question. That's a whole other class. It's a great question. Yeah. Yeah. That would be, yeah. I mean, it's a huge question. Yeah. I am trying to think of a short answer to give you. Yeah. I mean, that means developing wisdom.
Get into it now, but something that Venerable Robina said, and we'll talk about it afterwards, it might help.
Okay. The Buddhist explanation of what, can we be happy and compassionate at the same time, or are they contradictory, is compassion is inevitably accompanied by a feeling of sadness. But sadness is not suffering or unhappiness. Go back to the definition I gave you of happiness. Experiencing something in a satisfying manner that we are comfortable with based on believing it is of benefit to ourselves. So I think if we go with that definition, we can almost say we can be sad and that's a happy feeling. Okay, we can experience the sadness for the compassion, for the suffering of others, but it does not cause us to suffer. Because we are comfortable with that, we accept it, we see it for what it is, and we know that that feeling is of benefit to us and that it's motivating us to develop and help others. So that's kind of the Buddhist, and that's how they explain things. You know, you can go to the dentist and get a root canal done and be happy from the Buddhist point of view. Not that you're not experiencing physical pain, but you're satisfied with the experience. You're comfortable with it. You know it's of benefit to yourself. So you're having physical pain, but the mental experience could be one of happiness, of non-suffering. Who's got a dentist appointment this week and can come back and report to us? let's see. I just want to finish up by reading a... a couple of paragraphs from Alex Berzin that he uses to summarize this part of what I've been talking about. We then expand our minds by turning our attention to the problems of others and how they may be in even worse situations than ours. We stop thinking of only ourselves. We think how wonderful it would be if all others could be free of their suffering, and how great it would be if we could give them, help them to accomplish that. This strong compassion naturally leads to a feeling of love, the wish for them to be happy. Compassion is the wish to others be free of suffering. Love is the wish they become happy. And love is, you know, that's a lot clearer. That's really kind of an invigorating, let's go, let's do it kind of feeling. Compassion has this sadness to it, but that's not necessarily suffering for ourselves to feel sadness. Thinking of their happiness triggers even more of our own potentials for happiness to ripen. With these thoughts of compassion and love, we may then turn our thoughts to the Buddhas or to any other great humanitarian figures. Thinking of their examples, we gain the inspiration to take some responsibility to actually try to help others. This helps us to gain the strength and courage to tackle not only the problems of others, but our own as well. But again, without exaggerating them and without worries about failures or expectations of success. So, any other comments before we do our dedication prayers? Okay,
we'll turn to the first pink sheet in the prayer book. And The dedications are a traditional time to make offerings to the Sangha and Dharma Center. We'll be passing generosity bowls in case you'd like to make a donation, or there are donation boxes in the lobby if you prefer to focus on the prayers instead. And we'll start with a prayer list. All those killed by natural and man-made disasters, all the Tibetans who have been killed or have taken their own lives in the struggle for religious freedom, Ron Burroughs, Claire Caruso, father of Jessica Dijkstra, Jane Haggerty, Bill Johnson, Claudia Kunt, Katrina Smith's mother, Jane, Dakota the dog, Frank the cat, Shanti the dog, Zavi the cat. Prayers for health and well-being, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, His Eminence Lama Zopa Rinpoche, His Eminence Ken Rinpoche Jetson Lodzong Delek, His Eminence Choden Rinpoche, Geshe Gelug Choda, Geshe Paulden Sango, Venerable Chökyila, all those harmed by natural and man-made disasters, for the Tibetan people and for the Chinese authorities, may the nonviolent path lead to full reconciliation and religious freedom. Jim Barnes, Lorelei Barnes, Roseanne Barona, Bobby and Lori, Ron Burroughs' family, Dr. Dinesh Chandok and his patients and family, Victoria Easterday Clark, Guillermo Garcia and family, Mildred Gooch, Annie Hassel, Leslie and Joan Inman, Kenny Jackson and Buddy, Bill Johnson's family, Helen Kasanoff, Wendy King, Shanti and Kurt Latimer, Vanessa Lillig and family, Rashika Mitra and family, Adrian Oliver, Doreen Palermo, Jameen Pandya, Jay Pandya, Aunt Polly, Chuck and Faye Renard, Rosemary Cease, Dion Washington, Judith Wormser, Barney the dog, and Chelsea the cat. Okay, so we'll begin with Shanti Deva's prayer at the top of the pink prayer sheet. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness, and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the misery of the world. And the long life prayer for His Holiness the Dalai Lama. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All powerful Chenrezig Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. Savior of the snow land teachings and transmigratory beings, who extensively clarifies the path that unifies emptiness and compassion. To the lotus in the hand, Lord Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech, may all your holy wishes be fulfilled. The one who mastered his speech at a very young age, the one with great patience who received the name Avatari, the one with great precision who spread the teachings of Lama Tsongkhapa on bliss and void, Lama, ornament of the yellow hat tradition, please remain until samsara ends. You who uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjana's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplish magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, Savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. And for Geshe Gelug's long and happy life, seven green Tara mantras. Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Soha. 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 Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re So Ha. Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re So Ha. Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re So Ha.